27. Bouncing back. I'm not sure I'd ever felt so proud as I walked into the shop. I could feel my chest puffing out like a toad's throat. In front of me were rows and rows of books, and on the front cover, yours truly. I reached out and tenderly fingered my glossy, smiling face. That might sound a bit weird, but it wasn't. I span flamboyantly on my heels, so I could look out of the window of the big-name High Street bookstore in which I stood. As humans of both sexes hurried and scurried about, I nodded in quiet satisfaction. Today, Norwich Waterstones, tomorrow, the Booker Prize for books. Allow me to explain. To begin, you must join me as I return to the year 2PD, post-Dundee. Alan Partridge is in a tiz. He can't figure out what to do with his experiences. He's been through a major male mind meltdown. Surely there's some good to come out of this. Then, one day in the bathtub, Ulrika, it hit me. I'd translate them into a publishing deal. As I searched around the soapy depths for my pumice stone, the idea began to take shape. The book would be called Bouncing Back. On the surface, it would appear to be half autobiography, half self-help manual. Yet it would be so much more than that. It would be a system to set free the limitless potential within us all, which just happened to be bound in hardback and sold in all good bookshops plus Tesco's. I got so caught up in thinking about the book that by the time I finally emerged from my bath, my skin was as shriveled as an over-microwaved pea. But you know what? I didn't care. My only focus now was on bouncing back. And I have to confess, I loved the writing process. Sometimes I'd sit in my study and just pound away on the word processor. Other times I'd go jogging with a Bluetooth headset on and get my assistant to type the chapters up when I spoke them to her. After what seemed like an eternity, the book was finally written. It had taken 3 long weeks. As I typed the very last word, Allah, I collapsed onto my keyboard. I was spent. Every last drop of me had been poured into that book, save for a couple of anecdotes that I took from Russell Harty and rebadged as my own, and there's nothing he can do to touch me. A wave of relief rushed over me as I began to dribble onto the space bar. If pony trekking had soothed my troubled mind, writing this book had been a full radiator flush, removing any traces of magnetite sludge from my system. My demons hadn't been exercised, they'd been rounded up and shot. And now, as I bulldozed them into a mass grave with a fag in my mouth, I could move on with my life. Of course, there was still the small matter of finding a publisher. My previous work, A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Stadium to Alan Partridge by Alan Partridge, a wry collection of amusing anecdotes about my experiences as a sports reporter, had been published by Peartree Publishing, the publishing wing of my now-defunct company. Peartree Productions had gone under years before after an injunction from a former goalkeeper, Ray Clemens, who angrily questioned the validity of one of my anecdotes. So we needed to source a new publishing house. I'm told by my assistant that it only took about a month. After all, anyone reading the manuscript would quickly see that snapping up the rights was a total no-brainer, but can't recall the exact details as I was drinking a lot of cider at the time. I don't really like cider, but there'd been a very good deal on at Thresher's, and this explained my somewhat distracted response when phoned with the good news. "I found you a publisher," she squeaked. "What? For your book? What about it? It's ace. You asked me to find you a publisher. For what?" "The book, Alan. You asked me to find you a publisher for the book, and I've spent the last month sending it to various companies, and now one has come back and said they're willing to publish it." I hesitated. Was the news sinking in? "Just get me some crisps." No, it wasn't. The next day, though, with all the cider now either drunk, spilled, or thrown, I soon shaped up, and let me tell you, I was elated. My strategy of combining searingly honest admissions about my own life with a liberal use of Roget's thesaurus had worked a treat. I was to be published. I immediately phoned Carol before quickly hanging up when I remembered we were divorced. Yet my happiness was to be short-lived. Sales were disappointing. My refusal to dumb down, if anything I'd dumbed up, had cost me dearly. I received word via fax that a lot of stores were going to take it down from the shelves. I was absolutely thunderstruck. Thanks, Roget's. I had to take matters into my own hands. Sales needed to be boosted, and fast. I quickly formulated a plan of action. Every day for the next fortnight, I would go down to Norwich train station, set up a stall, and see if I could shift a few units myself. It would be stripped-down concourse retailing in its purest form. I launched myself into it like a small circus man being shot from a cannon. What a buzz. I'd literally flog to anyone. It didn't matter if they were travelling into Norfolk, trans-county, or intra-Anglian. They were all fair game as far as I was concerned. I felt like I could sell coal to the Eskimos. I was rigged up with one of those cordless mics that you fix to your head. I loved it, with its sponge-covered microphone dangling in front of my mouth like a big black grape. I remember the first book I sold to a W.H. Smith customer. He was a man by the name of Warren. Before he'd been sucked into my sales tractor beam, he'd been innocently copying out a recipe for white bean stew from the BBC Good Food magazine. Yet within minutes he was writing me a cheque. £8.99 poorer, but one very good book richer. And I remember I did use those exact words. It might seem weird that I remember the name of a man who bought a book from me almost 15 years ago, but in my defence, he did have a lisp. Not that I realised at first. I thought he was just being silly. But the more I chatted to him, the clearer it became. There were no two ways about it. This man had a disabled mouth. Out of interest, I inquired if it entitled him to a badge for his car. It didn't. Justice? Not in this world, mate. Good on him, though. He could have stayed at home, resenting his impediment, a cutout of a big letter S on his dartboard. But no, here he was, bold as brass, out and about. He may not have been able to say the word sausages, or the word say, come to think of it. But nothing, I mean nothing, was going to stop him getting the 10.02 to Newmarket from Platform 9. If memory serves, he needed a new Ethernet cable from PC World. Something, he noted with a wry smile, that he could ask for safe in the knowledge that everyone involved would remain bone dry. And besides, if he did suddenly get a craving for sausages on his way back, he could simply bob into Morrison's and get them from the chill cabinets. He'd never actually have to say the S-word, unless he was insistent on buying direct from a butcher. In which case, just point. That's what Mike Tyson does. No, I liked this guy. As I pretended to have an itchy cheek so I could wipe away another fleck of spittle from my face, I understood that we all have our crosses to bear. His just happened to be a chubby tongue. It was incredible to think that the letter S, such a simple concept to even the youngest of children, was like a foreign country to this man. It was the enemy in a lifelong war his mouth was never going to win. Like a kind of oral IRA, pre-ceasefire. Before he left, he was good enough to take a photo of me for posterity. See picture section. Sadly, though, my one-man, station-based sales frenzy only delayed the inevitable. Alas and alack, Roger's again, I had failed. I started to sense something might be wrong when I received an email entitled, "Bouncing Back is Going to be Pulped." My God, this couldn't be real. What was being proposed was nothing short of literary genocide. I picked up the phone to Henry Chesney, my contact at the publishing company. "Henry, there has been some sort of mistake here." "There's no mistake." "Damn you, man, we can turn this round, I know we can." "We're not doing a raft of nationwide TV adverts, Alan." "Okay, then a stunt. We'll make a house out of 1,000 copies of Bouncing Back. Then bequeath it to the homeless. We'll be on the front page of every paper in the land of Norwich. Though the structure might lose rigidity if it rains." "The book's being pulped tomorrow. It's over, Alan."
"Henry, I'm begging you. I'm literally on my knees."
"It sounds like you're driving."
"Okay, then, not literally. Just throw me a bone here, buddy."
"Well, if it's any consolation, you're more than welcome to go along to the pulping." I hung up in an explosion of fury. Go to the pulping of my own book. How dare he? How dare he? I was deeply moved by what I saw at the paper mill the following day. I did go after all. I decided to take some sandwiches and make a day of it. It seemed only right that I should pay my respects. There was great dignity in seeing 14,000 copies of my book being ferried along a conveyor belt to their certain death, as they jiggled and jaggled their way into the jaws of a state-of-the-art pulping machine. It was all I could do not to stand bolt upright and salute. Those poor bastards. Of course, it wasn't goodbye, though. It was just au revoir. After all, my fallen brothers would soon have an exciting new life as recycled paper. Sometimes, if I'm feeling a bit blue, I sit down in my favourite armchair with a big mug of milky coffee, shut my eyes, and imagine what could have become of every trounced copy of Bouncing Back. I like to think me and the odd fragment have met again in the years since. Yes, I like to think that very much indeed. An A4 jot book from Ryman's. A love letter from one man to his troubled bisexual fuck buddy. Or maybe a ream of high-grade printed paper purchased by a thriving local business. Shoved into the tummy of a Canon IP2000, it would bide its time until one day, emerging kicking and screaming into the world, caked in the latest set of company financials. Of those three, the one I'm least keen on is the fuck buddy. The only option I'm not prepared to risk is toilet paper. That's why I insist on buying foreign these days, and hang the cost. If it's not been imported, it's not going within a yard of my exit chute. And if the shop only has British, then I just make do with a wet wipe or a splash wash. Never mind all that, though, because I actually had a really good day at the paper mill. By the end of my time there, I felt I'd really come to understand it. "If books really do need to be destroyed," I screamed at the foreman over the deafening roar of the machinery, "this is definitely the most humane way of doing it." He didn't hear me, but it didn't matter. I'd made my point. Call me an old softy, but as a memento, I asked if I could take home a doggy bag of Bouncing Back sluddy. To my delight, the foreman agreed, and that bag now has pride of place at the back of my attic.